This is the NPR News Update for Thursday, August 15th. Minnesota News on your schedule. I'm Perry Finelli. On the podcast today, a patient experience survey finds most Minnesotans satisfied with the way their medical providers interact with them. St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman says there needs to be an immediate increase in police presence on the city's east side. And controversy over the proposed Southwest Corridor light rail line is raising questions about the most basic element of the project, its route. State officials released the July Minnesota jobs numbers this morning. Check NPRnews.org for the results. The unemployment rate in June was 5.2%, down 0.1% from May. The state has added 54,000 jobs in the last year. Governor Mark Dayton says he's growing more confident in the potential success of Minnesota's new state-run health insurance exchange. Dayton previously said he thought the online marketplace, known as MinSure, could be a big gamble. On Wednesday, Dayton said he thinks Minnesota's exchange has the leadership needed to be the best in the country, but he said there could still be a few problems ahead.
The computer system, of course, is, you know, that's the big unknown. It's one thing to start a small business small and then grow it. We're starting a gigantic business on day one, and, you know, there will be challenges and glitches inevitably.
Dayton also noted the challenge posed by some opponents of the new health care law. He said there are a number of people who want to undermine and sabotage the system to make it fail for political purposes. The state exchange must be ready by October and will take effect in January. Patients often seek suggestions from friends and family members when they're looking for a doctor who will treat them with respect and listen to their concerns. Now there is an official source of patient satisfaction information that assesses physicians at virtually every clinic in the state. A patient experience survey shows most patients are satisfied with the way their medical providers interact with them, but many would like easier access to their doctor. Lorna Benson reports.
The independent ratings group Minnesota Community Measurement announced the findings after compiling data from 230,000 patient surveys completed at 651 Minnesota clinics last fall. Clinics are required to collect the data as part of Minnesota's 2008 health reform law. Jim Chase, president of Minnesota Community Measurement, described the results as a major milestone in Minnesota's effort to make healthcare more transparent. He said Minnesota now has a statewide measure that can paint an accurate picture of patient experiences across a broad range of patients.
I think we're going to see a lot more people looking at patient experience because it's something they can relate to. And it's a reason why many of the groups are interested in collecting this data, too, because they know it's very important for their patients and they want to be responsive.
The survey measured patients' access to care, along with interactions and communication with physicians and office staff. Patients were asked if their doctor knew their medical history. Other questions looked at how well physicians explain things, whether they listened carefully, showed respect, spent enough time with the patient, and provided easy-to-understand instructions. On average, 90% of patients gave their doctors high marks for their ability to communicate. On another measure, 78% of patients rated their physician 9 or 10 on a 10-point scale. Clinic staff fared slightly better in the survey than physicians, with 92% of patients saying that staff members at their clinic were helpful and respectful. Ed Ellinger is commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health, which was a partner on the survey project.
For providers, this information creates a statewide benchmark that they can use to learn about their strengths and weaknesses to help them improve the quality of care and the patient experience.
Access to care was one area in the survey where many clinics did not score top marks. Only 60% of patients said they experienced top-level access at their clinics. Top-level access was defined as seeing a provider within 15 minutes of an appointment and being able to make an appointment for care as soon as a patient needed it. It also included receiving timely answers to questions when a patient would call the clinic. Darlene Hafner said the survey findings should be helpful to patients, but she says they're not a substitute for taking charge of your own health care. The 61-year-old Bloomington resident attended the announcement on the survey results to encourage other patients to speak up for themselves. A few years ago, Hafner said she had a frustrating experience dealing with her providers during a complication from her Crohn's disease, and she says the experience likely delayed the surgery she ultimately needed.
I really felt that we had had a lack of communication between the providers and the technicians and to myself, and we didn't really seem to be on the same page.
After that experience, Hafner wrote a letter to her physician explaining how she felt about the care she received. She said her doctor thanked her for contacting her about the problem and said it had been a good learning experience for her as a physician.
I think we need to remember that if the doctors don't know what our situation is from the patient's perspective, you can't work together to solve the problem.
Public health officials hope that by sharing the survey information with the public, they will make it easier for patients to choose the physician who is right for them. Lorna Benson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The controversy over whether to allow state-subsidized child care providers to unionize has largely overshadowed the other group of workers covered by the same new Minnesota law. In-home personal care assistants who work with elderly and disabled people have been quietly moving closer to their own vote on whether to form a union. And the decision is dividing some of the people who spend much of their time caring for loved ones. Tim Pugmire reports.
Come on in, Tim. This is Christine.
Mark Kerwin has been caring for his wife, Christine, in their northeast Minneapolis home for more than 20 years. Christine has multiple sclerosis. Although she's still able to live at home, her worsening condition now requires Mark to get help from nurses and to use a lot of medical equipment.
So, she's on a ventilator and she has a little bit of oxygen that runs. She has to be on a monitor for her oxygen and pulse. And she's on a feeding tube, and she gets nebulizer treatment, and she needs to be suctioned regularly.
Mark Kerwin gets the money he needs to care for his wife through a state program called Consumer Directed Community Supports. He's among an estimated 12,000 care providers in various taxpayer-supported programs who will get a chance to vote on whether to join a union. Kerwin said he thinks union representation will help people like him. He said it could also help protect a program that can save the state money by caring for people in their own homes rather than in more expensive nursing homes.
I think a lot of people have trouble understanding the value of home care workers. You know, they've never had to, face this type of situation, having to choose between going to work and providing care for a loved one. So they don't really see, the value in it.
The Service Employees International Union announced its campaign to organize personal care assistants and other direct support workers shortly after last fall's election, when labor-friendly Democrats won majorities in the Minnesota House and Senate. The resulting bill that DFL Governor Mark Dayton signed into law in May authorized the PCA vote to move forward, as well as the separate effort to unionize some in-home child care providers. There are passionate advocates and harsh critics within the PCA ranks. Catherine Held of Burnsville cares for her 9-year-old daughter Charlotte, who has a genetic disorder.
I'm her mom, and the unionization, it doesn't make, who am I going to unionize against? Who am I going to bargain with? Who am I going to barter with? It doesn't make any sense to me. And all that's going to end up happening is the money that my daughter gets because she's special needs is going to go into the union's pocket instead of being used for her.
Union opponents went to court this summer to try to stop the child care provider part of the law from moving forward. A federal judge dismissed the two cases, but one is being appealed. The PCA effort has not encountered any similar hurdles, but Held said that could be changing soon.
I've actually been in touch with other PCAs, and that is our plan, that we would also seek to file a federal lawsuit to stop the unionization effort.
Not all PCAs care for their own family members, and it's a low-wage, high-turnover job. Jamie Gully, president of the union group SEIU Healthcare Minnesota, said collective bargaining is a way to address what he views as a workforce crisis, by making the profession more attractive at a time of growing demand for such services. Gully said he's not concerned about any potential lawsuits.
It's no surprise there are some individuals in the state of Minnesota that are just anti-union and don't think that anyone should be allowed to have a union, much less PCAs. But right now we're not too worried about that. We're really focused on talking to PCAs about what kind of future that they want to have for this profession.
Gully said SEIU is now waiting for the Minnesota Department of Human Services to compile a list of all current PCAs who would be eligible to vote in a union election. The union can proceed with that election once they've collected the signatures of 30% of the eligible PCAs. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News.
This is the NPR News Update. St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman is proposing a city budget with no increase in property taxes. However, that does not mean everyone is happy with the mayor's proposal. Curtis Gilbert reports.
This is only the second time Coleman has proposed holding taxes flat during his 8 years in office. The city's property tax levy increased by about 50% during that time period, and it now stands at about $100 million. City Council President Kathy Lantry says the state is partially responsible for those past tax hikes because it repeatedly cut the amount of local government aid it sent to St. Paul. But in introducing Coleman today, Lantry said things have changed.
This year, we've been granted a reprieve. Yay, clapping. Okay, from what has become, I know it's a really big deal.
With DFLers in control at the state capitol, St. Paul saw a $10 million bump in state aid. That extra money will allow the city to hold the line on taxes. But Coleman says in spite of the reprieve, the city still faces challenges. Costs will continue to rise, and it's doubtful state aid will keep pace. Coleman says that means St. Paul can't afford to be complacent.
We'll be unable to enhance or even maintain the level of services unless we think things out a different way. And we'll have the worst of all worlds. Increases in taxes, and decreases in service.
Coleman wants St. Paul to hire a consultant who will help it become more efficient. He's also establishing a city innovations team, an approach he says has succeeded in other cities around the country, including Louisville, Kentucky.
Louisville alone has accomplished a number of efficiencies. Among them are strategies which reduce the number of low-severity 911 calls and thus unnecessary EMS runs. It's time for St. Paul to catch up.
To catch up, the police department plans to buy software that will allow citizens to report low-level crimes using the internet. Police Chief Tom Smith says there's no reason the city needs to keep taking those reports by phone.
Sometimes people will call us on a garage burglary or a bike that's been stolen, and they tell us they don't need an officer to respond, but they need a police report, primarily for insurance purposes. Those calls come in all the time, but those are the type of crimes people can report online.
Smith says once the new system is implemented, it'll free up three officers who'll no longer need to sit at a desk to answer the phone. Those officers will be able to get back on the street. Coleman's budget also contains two new civilian positions in the police department, crime analysts, who use statistics to find crime patterns and solve cases. While the budget contains no tax increases, it does hike a couple of fees. The average homeowner will spend $8 a year more for street maintenance. There's also an $11 a year increase in the cost of recycling. Environmental Policy Director Ann Hunt says that extra money will allow the city to accept more kinds of plastic and eliminate the need for residents to sort recyclables into two bins.
Starting in 2014, you'll be able to put all of your recyclable material in the same container. So that's paper and office paper, cans and glass, all the new plastics, phone books, all those things can go in one container.
A group of residents has been pushing the city to go even further with recycling. They want to be able to save food scraps from going into the landfill, too. But composting didn't make it in the budget this year because of concerns over costs and questions about whether enough residents would participate in such a program. Tim Brownell is the CEO of Eureka Recycling, the nonprofit organization that runs St. Paul's recycling program. Brownell says recycling more types of plastic is great, but the city still throws way too much away.
What's still in that garbage stream is at least 25 to 30% of that material is compostable.
Minneapolis has been piloting a composting program in a few neighborhoods for the last 5 years, but it hasn't rolled the program out citywide yet. Coleman says he wants St. Paul to get into the composting business eventually, but it won't happen in the 2014 budget. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News, St. Paul.
Residents of St. Paul's East Side meet with representatives from the police department and Ramsey County Attorney's Office tonight to discuss the beating of a young man earlier this month. Rupa Shenoy reports.
26-year-old Ray Widstrand tried to walk through what police say was a gang fight at about 11:30 at night on August 4th. He was beaten and kicked and left with near-fatal brain swelling. Eric Foster owns the restaurant Ward 6. He says the incident should not reinforce old misconceptions of the area as dangerous.
It's one of the sad things about the East Side is that when anything bad happens on the East Side, the entire area gets sort of the bad reputation, which is not to minimize at all what happened. You know, it's a terrible, terrible thing, but the East Side is a big place.
At his annual budget address yesterday, St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman called for an immediate increase in police presence on the East Side. Rupa Shenoy, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Controversy over the proposed Southwest Corridor light rail line is raising questions about the most basic element of the project, its route. Soaring costs and a dilemma over where to put existing freight rail lines are causing some critics to demand that light rail planners slow down the process. Laura Ewan reports.
Patty Schmitz wanted to follow the rules. As a Minneapolis resident who lives just blocks from the chosen Southwest light rail route, she's watched elected officials and transit planners toil over how to resolve the freight rail dispute. Schmitz thinks they've come up with three really bad options, but she never considered that the LRT route itself could be challenged this far into the planning process.
Because all along we have said they're not going to reopen the alignment, it's not going to happen. Everyone is saying it's a done deal.
It's almost like you never really wanted to even go there.
No, because we were told we couldn't go there.
But she says when the Star Tribune editorial page raised questions about the route.
I think, you know, we all wanted to jump up and down with joy.
Schmitz is part of a small citizens group called LRT Done Right. And now they're demanding that light rail planners go back to the drawing board.
So this is the narrow part.
Schmitz stands just a few paces away from the freight tracks in the Kenilworth corridor that has become the epicenter of the problem. Bicyclists zip by on trails that run parallel to the tracks. The Met Council wants to squeeze in light rail here, too. Two of the options call for burying the light rail to make room for the bike trail and freight trains, but both of these tunnel options are controversial, and neither comes cheap. Under the more expensive scenario, the original cost estimates for the project jumped from about $1.3 billion to $1.8 billion. Planners chose this route years ago after considering matters of cost and potential ridership to satisfy a federal funding formula that no longer applies. Schmitz notes that the route skirts the heart of Uptown, which is teeming with new condos and apartments.
It just would make so much more sense if it went down an area where there's more populous.
In fact, planners did consider such a route. Under that plan, the trains would roll down the Midtown Greenway and veer toward downtown on Nicollet Avenue.
This isn't something new. This Midtown, Nicollet, Midtown, whatever, is not new. It's been looked at. It's been done. Anybody that would have done their research would know that.
Jim Brimmeyer is a Met Council member representing St. Louis Park, and he's got a long memory. He says planners rejected the Uptown route, not only because of its hefty price tag, but also because it would have disrupted businesses and historic properties. Brimmeyer and other members of a key advisory board for the project aren't entertaining the idea of a reroute. Hennepin County Commissioner Gail Dorfman says just because the freight rail issue has created an impasse doesn't mean planners should start from square one.
We can plan this forever and feel good about our planning process and try to include as many people as possible. And we heard everything and we discussed everything and we studied everything. And so now I think is the time to move on and get this done.
Many people close to the project say picking a new route isn't likely at this point. The Met Council says that would strike Southwest from the competitive queue for federal transit projects, and each year of delay could add up to $50 million in costs. The project also risks losing funding if it can't resolve major decisions. In neighboring St. Louis Park, residents worry that the Met Council will move forward with the last of three options, relocating the freight trains through their city. Planners have suggested running the lines on a hill as tall as two stories high. Jamie LaPre, with the group Safety in the Park, says running the track through a neighborhood near a school is worrisome.
The troubling portion of this is the fact that it's on the berm, and if there were to be a derailment, logic tells us that it would be catastrophic, having a 270,000-pound rail car tumbling down the side of a hill.
But unlike some of her counterparts in Minneapolis, LaPre isn't calling for a reroute of light rail. She says it's time to move the project forward. The Met Council is expected to decide on the freight issue in late September. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
This is the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Opponents of Minnesota's wolf hunt are gathering signatures to urge state officials to suspend this year's hunt. Howling for Wolves and several other advocacy groups say a population survey showing a decline in the state's wolf population is reason enough to suspend the hunt. Howard Goldman is with the Humane Society of the United States. He says breeding wolves killed during the hunt could affect the overall population.
Reproduction will decline significantly. And most troubling of all is that we may not know the full impact on the packs for several years. Now, we're urging the governor and the legislature to take a step back suspend the hunt.
The DNR says the state's wolf population declined by about 24% from 2008 to last winter. But DNR researchers have said the population can still sustain a hunt. About 400 wolves were killed during last year's hunt. This year, the DNR has reduced the quota to 220. The EPA sees significant progress in the environmental review of the proposed PolyMet mining project in northeast Minnesota. It's according to a letter sent to the state and federal agencies overseeing the review. Dan Crocker reports.
Last week, the EPA sent a letter to the Minnesota DNR and other agencies that have drafted the preliminary environmental review of the mine project. The EPA said it reflects significant progress in designing and clearly documenting the project. 3 years ago, the EPA sharply criticized the project's first environmental impact statement, but the federal agency has cooperated on the new review, which incorporates several environmental changes. Letitia Geetson is a PolyMet spokeswoman.
This is a very positive step forward in the process.
Environmental groups caution the letter shouldn't be interpreted as an endorsement of the project. They say it still points out 14 pages of concerns. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
Opponents of the New Era Wind Energy Project in southeastern Minnesota are getting ready to celebrate its defeat. Elizabeth Dunbar reports.
Those living near the proposed site of the wind turbines have fought the project since 2008. They've argued the turbines could kill bald eagles and other wildlife and negatively affect residents' quality of life. Marie McNamara, who co-founded the group Good Hugh Wind Truth, says she hopes citizen activists like herself have had an impact on more than just the New Era project.
I hope the state is looking a lot harder at the projects because I think we have some bad actors out there. And I still think there's other projects in Minnesota that don't look like they're real viable. They have some impacts that are not being examined.
The project's last setback happened in June when state officials said the company needed to improve its study on how the project would impact birds. The project's owner hasn't returned messages seeking comment. The company missed a deadline last week to advise state regulators on whether it intends to proceed. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A report says flowers used to create backyard bee habitats might actually kill bees. Dan Gunnarsson explains.
An environmental group bought plants at retailers in three cities, including Minneapolis-St. Paul. They found more than half of the plants contained a neonicotinoid insecticide dangerous for bees. The insecticide is taken up by the plant as it grows, so it's in the flowers and pollen. Lex Horan with the Pesticide Action Network says consumers don't know the plants they buy are treated with insecticide.
None of them were labeled as potentially harmful to bees. And so that means that there are home gardeners who may be going to buy plants that they know pollinators like and planting them in their backyards, hoping to help bees by creating habitat. And what they're actually doing is creating landscapes that are toxic to bees.
Environmental groups say consumers should ask retailers about the insecticide before buying plants, or grow their own plants from untreated seeds. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Moorhead.
And finally, movies about teenagers are a staple of mall megaplexes, especially at this time of year. But director James Ponsoldt argues the vast majority of them rarely depict the realities of teen life. Ewan Kerr reports Ponsoldt hopes to change that with his new film, The Spectacular Now, which opens in Minnesota this weekend.
James Ponsoldt tells a story about when the writers of his latest film went on a research trip, questioning teenagers about their lives. They asked one high school student to name the movie or book that best captured the teenage experience.
She thought about it for a while, and then she said, Harry Potter. And no disrespect to Harry Potter, but there was a collective sigh amongst all of us. We're trying to be a corrective to that.
Ponsoldt believes Hollywood hasn't made a realistic movie about teen life since Say Anything, which came out in 1989. There are shades of that movie in The Spectacular Now. In it, a high school senior named Sutter tries to drown his sorrows after his girlfriend dumps him. The next thing he knows, he's waking up on a stranger's lawn and someone's poking him.
Where the hell's my car?
I don't know. Do you live around here, Sutter?
How do you know my name?
You go to the same school. You wouldn't know who I am.
I know you.
I'm Amy. Amy Finicky.
That's what I was going to say. Nice to meet you, Amy.
Sutter is well known around school as a party boy with a much-used hip flask. Amy is a bookish introvert. Sutter is all about living for right now. Amy has dreams, but has convinced herself they will never come true. they become a couple, with dramatic consequences for them both.
This is a story that deals with first love, first heartbreak, first sex, there's car accidents, so much happens that it's on the verge of being histrionic at times.
Which director James Ponsoldt argues is entirely appropriate, because The Spectacular Now is about teenagers. Ponsoldt has made a number of features, including last year's comedy drama Smashed. He usually prefers to write his own scripts, but then he received the adaptation of Tim Tharp's novel, The Spectacular Now.
It felt like someone had actually written the story of my adolescence, and it felt so personal and so shockingly like it was my story that someone else had just sort of taken out of the ether. I felt that I had to engage with it.
In the story, Sutter and Amy fall in love, and they also really hurt each other.
It's a much more murky relationship that's somewhat codependent, not entirely healthy, and yet they do change each other's lives. And I think people sometimes can be upset by that, that it's not neat and tidy.
These are characters who bleed when they are cut, Ponsoldt says. He credits his two young stars, Shailene Woodley as Amy and Miles Teller as Sutter, for their commitment to their performances.
They wanted to go to places that were uncomfortable, and they didn't, and they brought no vanity whatsoever. You know, we really didn't put much makeup on them, and we wanted them to feel like regular kids, and I think they really mined the pain from their own lives.
Ponsoldt has been touring the world with The Spectacular Now, going from festival to festival. He recently introduced a screening before a sold-out audience at the Walker Arts Center in Minneapolis. He says the questions after the film revealed an engaged and intelligent audience. As a filmmaker, he loves that immediate feedback, but now the tours are coming to an end.
I don't know. It makes me sad. I don't know that it gets any better than this, really.
But don't worry about James Ponsoldt. He's got plenty to do. He's working on a film about the young Hillary Rodham before she met Bill Clinton. He also hopes someday to make a movie out of stories by Minnesota writer Ben Percy, his friend, who is trying to revitalize the werewolf genre. Ewan Kerr, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And that's the NPR News Update for Thursday, August 15th. I'm Perry Finelli. Join us again tomorrow. Thanks for listening.